visiting Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. This is in Basair al-Darajat, page 512. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, فَيَدُعُ النَّاسَ إِلَىٰ كِتَابِ اللَّهِ وَنَبِيِّهِ. Mahdi will invite the people toward the Book of God and toward the Prophet. So this is the first point. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, before inviting, he doesn't do any action before guiding the people.
Mm-hmm.
First, he tries to guide all the people. Secondly,
the same way that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did in Karbala, till some minutes before his martyrdom.
Very good point, yeah.
Yeah.
The second point is that not only the Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, I mean, he will invite the people toward the religion and toward guidance, he will perform various miracles. This is also interesting.
Mm.
There are some narrations which tell us that for convincing some people, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will also perform some miracles. We know that one of the ways that people can come to this understanding that this is a true prophet or true imam is through the miracle. For example, in some narrations we read that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will do various miracles which were performed by the previous prophets and imams. So the second point that I would like to mention is that we should not think that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will take his sword and begin killing the people without inviting the people toward the truth. No, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will invite the people toward guidance, and even he will perform miracles, and that is why, according to our narration, the great majority of the people will accept the invitation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Shias know that he is the promised Mahdi, the son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. Sunnis will come to this understanding that he is the promised Mahdi. Christians will know that he is the savior because he is accompanied by Jesus and the followers of other religions and even the atheists. Through the miracles, they can come to this conclusion that this is a true imam and leader.
So this is the time, I think, to purify our looks towards this issue and remove this distorted image of the Mahdi or the imam of the age, the imam who is coming to bring tranquility and peace to the human beings, that he is not coming to do a massacre on Muslims, or as the this weird hadith claims, to do the massacre on Arabs or even on Ahlus Sunnah, which definitely it cannot be true. So it's the time for us to, inshallah, remove these obstacles and reappearance of Imam. That is, to work more on the unification of the Islamic Ummah rather sort of, let's say, division among the Islamic beliefs by finding some, I don't know, trivial or authenticated hadith in this realm.
The last savior.
The question comes in my mind: what next?
What next?
There are references to a person who will come as the savior of mankind.
I know he's one of the Ahl Bayt and the last one, and he's going to change the world.
So, Shaykhun, is there any point left here to finalize the discussion or no?
There are some remaining points regarding those narrations talking about killing of Murja'a by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We said that these are not authentic narrations, but again, we need to analyze
actually
the content.
It goes again the same line that said from Arabs, started from Arabs, then Ahlus Sunnah, and then now goes to Murja'a.
He believes that Murja'a in these narrations refer to Ahlus Sunnah, but this is a mistake that inshallah I will explain in the following session. And he also refers to some narrations according to which some of the Nasibis will be killed by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. As I mentioned, let me continue along the last point that I mentioned. according to some narrations, believed, for example, by a narration in Bahá'u'lláh.
So they wanted to, sorry, before you continue, Sheikh, they wanted to compare the, or let's say, to put Murji'ah instead of Ahlus Sunnah in the same hadith, right? How, based on what, let's say, logic did they come to this conclusion that Murji'ah can be placed here?
This is a mistake, as I mentioned. When we refer to the scholars of Islamic denominations, both from Shia and Sunni, we see that Murji'ah, according to these scholars, they were a group which appeared after the demise of the Prophet. They believed in faith being only, a matter of heart without actions.
Look at your heart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, or for example, according to some scholars, they believe that having faith, acts of disobedience, do not harm one's faith. It's been mentioned by different Sunni scholars, for example, Nawawi in his commentary on Sahih Muslim, Ibn al-Hajar in Fathul Bari, many other Sunni scholars and Shia scholars as well. So to claim that Murji'ah in these narrations refer to Ahl Sunnah is a very big mistake committed by this Wahhabi scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we mentioned that the narration is also weak regarding the chain of the narration. But when it comes to Nawasib, that narration mentioned by this Wahhabi scholar was authentic, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that even greater mistake to, consider Nawasib as referring to the Ahl Sunnah. It's a very big mistake. Again, I refer to the many books of Shia and Sunni scholars defining the word Nasibi when, as it is mentioned in some of the narrations. According to Islamic terminology, Nasibi is a person who shows animosity toward the Ahlul Bayt, toward the children of the Prophet. He, in his action, outwardly, he shows that he's an enemy to the
Ahlul Bayt. We cannot see such a thing among the Ahlul Sunnah.
Exactly.
And fortunately, the kind of, let's say, look that is ruling here in the, let's say, in the proof that this brother, or the arguments this brother raises, actually cannot be seen in among the Sunni researchers. When I'm talking about Sunni scholars, I'm actually deducing Wahhabis, those with Wahhabi orientation. No, and Sunnis in general, we cannot see such a trend, such a literature.
Exactly. We have had
them.
Few people who were so at the time of, for example, Muawiyah, and after him in some parts of Levant, for example. And anyway, if we have today, they are very, very few in number. You cannot imagine any Muslim nowadays to have hatred toward Imam Ali alayhi salam, Fatimah Zahra salamullah alayha, or Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Let me conclude with quoting Sheikh As-Saduq. He says that only the ignorant people assume that any person who is not a Shia, he is a Nasibi. This is not true. And Sheikh Ansari, the great Shia scholar, says that to believe that all the non-Shi'as are Nasibi is a great mistake.
Many thanks. Those who have been living among the Sunni communities, they know that how great they love the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and how they respect them, actually, in a beautiful manner that we sometimes actually wish to be loving like them. Anyhow, we have been among the Sunni brothers and sisters, and we know how for actually devoted the art was Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and all these things are going to spread the seed of discord among the Islamic Ummah and the Muslim communities and Islamic denominations. I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
World with reporters. China is building up nearly 3,000 kilometer long network of roads, railway lines, and investing tens of billions of US dollars in Pakistan's energy and infrastructure projects under its mega Belt and Road global initiative. The major road infrastructure links western China to deep water port in southwest of Pakistan, 75 kilometers east of Iran, at the top of Arabian Sea. The U.S. feels threatened over expansion of Chinese economic influence in the rest of the world through Gwadar Port, which also serves as an alternative option for Beijing in the event of military blockade of Chinese Navy in South China Sea by the U.S. and its allies. The U.S. has been pressurizing Pakistan into shelving Chinese mega projects, calling it a debt trap. Washington has been struggling hard to win over Islamabad in its what appears to be a cold war with Beijing over growing Chinese economic influence in the world.
Pakistan thinks that it is very unfair for the US or other powers, Western powers, for countries like us to take sides. Why do we have to take sides?
It's not going to happen that if Pakistan is, there's pressure put on Pakistan to change its relationship or downgrade its relationship with China. It won't happen. Our relationship between the two countries, no matter what pressure is put on us, is not going to change.
We do not expect that living at the backyard of such a rising power, which happens to be luckily our strategic partner, how could we downgrade our relation with them and side or be more close with someone who's 10,000 miles away. So it is very unrealistic to expect of Pakistan. Militarily, we would not involve ourselves in the conflicts of the region.
The unprecedented cold shouldering to the US has followed series of Pakistan's policy decisions to no longer get itself involved in any US-driven military conflict across the region. Islamabad has outrightly rejected the US request to set up military bases in Pakistan. The American CIA chief, William Byrne, who was on a secret visit to Pakistan a few weeks ago, was reportedly snubbed upon his request to see Prime Minister to reconsider his decision on military bases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Aside from the enormous death toll, COVID-19 has wreaked economic havoc across the 27-nation EU. The Brussels Economic Forum, the European Commission's flagship annual event focusing on the economy, has just heard that young people have been disproportionately impacted.
We have a whole generation of youth that have had their education and their early labor market careers disrupted. So we really have to pay attention to those groups and try to move forward better.
Apparently, the EU is ill-equipped to create jobs because it's behind the curve when it comes to the digital technology sector.
Before, we were just lagging behind the United States and Japan at some stage. Mm-hmm. Now we are lagging behind the US and China.
Education systems in the EU need to be reformed so that young people can receive training for quality jobs, it has been suggested.
If you're from the north of Europe or the south of Europe, the east of the west, young people desire one thing. They want to build a future, they want to build a family, and this comes with a quality job.
The EU's handling of the coronavirus pandemic was criticized at the Brussels Economic Forum. A senior official recalls Russian medical supply trucks rolling into his home country of Italy in February 2020.
They had written in the tracks from Russia with love, and that in the same weeks we had export bans of medical equipment among European countries.
The EU's slow response to the pandemic has economic consequences, experts point out.
The United States, earlier than Europe, made huge progress on vaccines as soon as Joe Biden came into office. It also put forward an even bigger economic recovery package.
The event heard that Western nations rely too heavily on the arms industry and financial services sector when it comes to growing GDP. That's the total monetary value of any given country.
In contrast, imagine a good society, a harmonious one, where people feel safe, where they are healthy.
Contributors reminded the Economic Forum the EU was still struggling from the 2008 financial crisis when COVID-19 arrived. They warn if citizens are not treated better this time, the EU will fall apart. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
The 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government, something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Ali Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt to muzzle the truth.
The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries. Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel.
hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voice their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if he weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. Quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Mina Taylor, London.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago, when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Farmers, traders, and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver the representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doubled the damage in the agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin the agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation, and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
And armed conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine, and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, The Best Hands. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Islam teaches its followers to aim for high aspirations, far-reaching endeavors, and strong affection. Therefore, it recommends its followers to avoid begging and dependency on others as far as they can. Not only that, it discourages Muslims from hoarding and keeping everything they have for their own exclusive benefit. Rather, they are urged to share their bounties with others as much as they can. And so we have a tradition that the best hands are the bountiful hands. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam says, there are three types of hands. Number one, begging hands. Number two, keeping hands. And number three, bountiful hands. And the best hands are bountiful hands. So if you see, we see in our society that there are people who, for one reason or another, I don't know how they convince themselves, that they are begging others all the time in order to fulfill the needs they have and their families have. They're on the outlook for just go and beg it from others, you know, just request some money all the time. They wouldn't want to work. They wouldn't want to struggle to earn that money. They wouldn't want to strive. They're just there for freebies, right? And then there are other keeping hands that are like keeping their wealth to themselves, not spending it, not giving it to others. They're being frugal. They're being miser. They're seeing that others are suffering, but they would not help. Then the third ones are bountiful hands. How beautiful, right? These are those who not only fulfill their own needs through working hard for earning their livings, but also help others. They see it as a responsibility on their shoulders, and indeed, they are the best and the bountiful hands. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the best hands. And before the break, we said that the bountiful hands are the best hands in the eyes of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The hands who are not frugal, who are not miser, the hands who are not begging in front of others. But these are the hands who earn their hard-earned living and then fulfill their own requirements and needs of living and then also help others to struggle and strive and survive through their charitable attitude. Now, most of us are taught the importance of sharing from a very young age. Giving to others is not only a way of providing ourselves with a sense of usefulness to others, but it also gives us a warm feeling of satisfaction in the knowledge that we are able to contribute something positive towards the world and the people who inhabit in it. Whether we choose to collect funds through a local charity event or raise awareness through sponsorships, the feel-good factor is ultimately what most of us look to accomplish for ourselves. While these are the worldly and the superficial and psychological benefits of giving in the way of Allah, a true follower of Islam, a true follower of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt shares bounties and blessings with others for the sake of Allah only. He doesn't do it for the worldly pleasures, for the respect. While all of those things may be there, they don't do it to feel good about it. They do it only for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is what the beauty of Islam is. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
English Radio.
In the limelight.
New York prosecutors may soon bring indictment against Trump Organization tied to perks for top executives, says David Smith, author, in an article published under the heading, Trump in Financial and Political Danger as Company Faces Possible Criminal Charges. Stay tuned for more. Donald Trump is facing a potentially crippling financial and political blow as the state prosecutors consider filing criminal charges against his family business recently. Prosecutors in New York could soon bring an indictment against the Trump Organization related to the taxation of lucrative perks that it gave to top executives, such as use of apartments, cars, and school tuition. The 45th president is not expected to be personally charged, but the legal drama could bankrupt his company by damaging his relationships with banks and other business partners, as well as clouding his political comeback. Ron Fischetti, a lawyer for the Trump Organization, held a virtual meeting with prosecutors recently for about 90 minutes in an effort to dissuade them from pursuing criminal charges against the company. The charges are absolutely outrageous and unprecedented. If needed, the charges are filed, Fischetti told the Associated Press recently, adding, this is just to get back at Donald Trump. We are going to plead not guilty and we will make a motion to dismiss. Fischetti and his colleagues had to make their final arguments against charges being brought, according to a report in the Washington Post. The long-running investigation by Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan district attorney, began after Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, paid hush money ahead of the 2016 presidential election to two women who alleged that they had sexual encounters with Trump. Trump denies the claim, however. There is now a particular focus on Alan Weisselberg, 73, the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, the private real estate conglomerate. Prosecutors are examining his son Barry's use of a Trump apartment at little or no cost, cars leased for the family, and tuition payments made to a school attended by Weisselberg's grandchildren. Such gifts and perks are worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. If the Weisselberg failed to account properly for that money on tax returns and other financial filings, they could be in legal jeopardy. But Fischetti insists that any criminal charges based on fringe benefits would represent a speculative break from precedent. We looked back 100 years of cases, and we haven't found one in which an employee has been indicted for fringe benefits, and certainly not a corporation, he told the AP, adding, to be a crime, it would have to be for the benefit of the corporation with the knowledge of the corporation. They don't have the evidence at all. Even so, a point of intrigue is whether Weisselberg will remain loyal to the former president or turn informant, potentially testifying against Trump, the company's owner, his son Don Jr. and Eric, who are executive vice presidents, and his daughter Ivanka. Trump, beaten by Joe Biden in last November's election, has long sought to dismiss the investigation as a witch hunt and remains politically active. He returned to campaign rallies, intends to be heavily involved in the 2022 midterm elections, and could run for president again in 2024. But there are signs that the walls are closing in. Vance, investigating possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct, has been scrutinizing Trump's tax records, subpoenaing documents, and interviewing witnesses, including Trump insiders and company executives. A grand jury was recently empaneled to look at the evidence. Meanwhile, Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, said she was assigning two lawyers to work with Vance on the criminal investigation while she continues her own civil investigation of Trump's business. James' office has been examining whether the Trump Organization inflated the values of some properties to obtain better terms on loans and lowered their values to obtain property tax breaks. Court records show some overlap between Vance and James' separate investigations, including their interest in Seven Springs, a 212-acre estate outside Manhattan that Trump purchased in 1995. James is examining a $21.1 million tax deduction taken when Trump agreed not to develop the property after local opposition thwarted his plan to build a golf course and a separate plan to build luxury homes was shelved. Trump has angrily denounced both investigations. In a statement released recently, he claimed the case was an extension of the Democrats' witch hunt against him. "They will do anything to stop the MAGA movement and me," he said, referring to the Make America Great Again campaign slogan, and insisting that the Trump Organization had merely done things that are standard practice throughout the U.S. business community and in no way a crime. The ex-president added, having politically motivated prosecutors, people who actually got elected because they will get Donald Trump, is a very dangerous thing for our country. In the end, people will not stand for it. Remember, if they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone, unquote. Trump's loss of power in Washington now deprives him, his family, and his company of legal protections he enjoyed while in the White House. The District of Columbia Attorney General's office, for example, is suing the Trump Organization and Presidential Inaugural Committee over the alleged misuse of more than $1 million for use of event space at the Trump Hotel in Washington during Trump's inauguration in January 2017. Ivanka, who was a senior advisor at the White House, sat for a deposition with investigators last December, but is in no imminent danger of criminal charges.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me brother Yasser Ibrahim one of the things that we should really pay attention to when we want to read a book or pick up a particular book that looks at a particular topic if you should look at the time frame in which that book was written in. The book that we would like to introduce today to our dear listeners has that particular condition on it because the book and the person who rather gave the lecture by which the book is based on was, you know, a long time ago and a lot of things have changed since then, both in the country that this person spoke in. Therefore, we see it not only has a particular time specific, it is also place specific. This is one of the most important things that we should understand. That not every book is general. Not every book can be applied everywhere else. This book is for a particular time, for a particular group of people. Yes, it does not mean that general principles cannot be extracted from it. But it requires more effort and more assistance to see that can these particular principles be applied to other places. And also the author, the views of the author, the academic background of the author, and so on and so forth, need also to be understood in his worldview. What is he trying to portray to us? So in the book, rather, which is a lecture that was given by the person or the author at a particular time, which was then translated into English, will be the subject of our next segment, inshallah. Please stay tuned until then.
They say, oh poor girl, you're so beautiful, you know. So lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart and seek the heart of purity.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Currently, we are discussing the book Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman by Dr. Ali Shariati, and the book has been translated by Lale Bakhtiar, who recently passed away. So this particular book, or rather, it's a booklet. It's a lecture that the author, Dr. Shariati, it doesn't say exactly where he gave it, but it is a lecture which was therefore then translated into English and it was printed into three parts. And the text discusses women's rights, the personality, and so on and so forth. And it tries to therefore give practical lessons and practical advice on this issue of women's rights. Women's, for example, social relationships, children's rights, family rights, and so on and so forth. Like I said, this book is time specific. A lot of these things that the author has mentioned has already been discussed and has changed. Because if you have to look at where we are today in the year 2021, this book is nearly 50 to 60 years old, if not more, this lecture that was given by the particular author. Hence, it may not be as relevant as we see it to be. So anyway, the author here obviously speaking at that particular time, obviously being at the time before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, maybe during a time of turmoil. It is not said exactly when the speech was given, as I mentioned, nor does it say when it was given. And he speaks about things that, you know, speak about certain traditional and cultural things that had or were occurring in Iran at that particular time. And then how is a person then able to change this and make it more Islamic in terms of Islamic upbringing, Islamic social relationships, and so on and so forth. And as I mentioned again, what is the author's definition of Islam? What does he mean by Islam? And all these type of things need to be acquired from the other books that the author may have. For as we know that Dr. Shariati was a socialist, was a person, what I mean by socialist, a person who was very socially active. A social activist is maybe a better word, but he was not a person who studied Islam in the Hausa or a traditional Hausa system. But this book, inshallah, may be beneficial to certain individuals who want to see as a historical background what the conditions of women were before the Islamic Revolution and after. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a part of this lecture, rather, from Dr. Shariati. Please stay tuned.
The Quran names several chapters in honor of women. Al-Nisa, or the woman, is one chapter. Or as the late Sheikh Ahmad Kuftaro taught, in defense of women. This chapter conveys many subjects regarding women's affairs and rights. Another chapter in the Quran devoted to women is named Al-Mujadila, or the woman with plea. There is yet another chapter in the Quran named Mary, after the Virgin Mary, mother of Jesus. These chapters constitute a giant step in the liberation of women from the earlier beliefs of superstition. Men shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Women shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Whether it be little or much, it is legally theirs. Quran 4:7.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program, Bookshelf on IRIB, English Radio. We've been discussing the book, or rather the lecture that was translated into English by Dr. Ali Shariati, known as Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman, that was translated by Lale Bakhtiar. So in the beginning of the book, in the very first chapters, the doctor speaks and mentions this. Prior to beginning my lecture, I would like to propose some practical suggestions. Speaking about women's rights, women's personality, and Islam's view of women differs a great deal from the realization of the actual value which Islam gives to human beings and to women in particular. Often we are satisfied by pointing out that Islam gives great value to science or establishes progressive rights for women. Unfortunately, we never actually use or benefit from these values or rights. We could benefit from these if we were to act according to the understanding which we acquire from them. Many people are acquainted with Islamic views of society, social relations, women's rights, children's rights, and family rights. But these same people tend to follow non-Islamic, ancient cultural traditions and do not dare to base their lives upon Islamic values. That is, they do not practice what they preach. Thus, we always remain at the level of talking. We must complete Islamic views and intellectual discussions with practical solutions. We must find a way whereby we reach these values and rights in practice. After proposing my views, the question should be asked, how can we actually put them into practice? Throughout history, the problem of women's rights and their role has always been considered to be an intellectual problem. Hence, various religious, philosophical, and social systems have reached varying views in this respect. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, until our next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
www.parstoday.com/en